Let's pray. That is the beauty of what is reality. The greatness of our God. We give our lives to know the greatness of our God. There's nothing that can separate us from the greatness of our God. And yet, Lord, this week, I'm sure many of us can say, well, from where I'm standing, there's plenty of things that seem to have separated me from the greatness of my God. I'm sure there's many of us who are saying, I feel very separated, very disconnected from the God of reality. Because if he was to look at me, if he was to look at my performance this week, he would obviously have to say, not good. And yet, because of the greatness of our God, that is not the case. That we are not separated because of our performance. And that there's nothing that can separate us from the beauty of knowing the God who is here through Jesus, the God who is real. And that is the God that we sing about. That is the God we long to know. And so we invite you right now, God, to be with us. And we ask you to join us as we look to your word for your glory. Amen. Well, good morning. It is great to be with you here today. And if you have your Bible, turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And as you're turning there, I would like for you to imagine that you are a startup business owner. I'd like for you to imagine that you have moved into a new area because you are an entrepreneur and you're starting this business. And, you know, things are going pretty well. You're kind of cranking ahead. You know, there's some days that aren't so good. Some days you feel like you're hitting your head against the wall, so to speak. And, you know, you're 18 months into it, and it's kind of like, is it going to go? Is it not? But you keep pushing through that. You keep working through it. And within a couple years, your business, in some sense, has really gone from zero to hero. You've really moved forward. And because you're an entrepreneur, you want to start something else. So you want to move to another town, or you want to move the business to another town. And so you recruit a very capable young leader who's just come out of business going, wow, I mean, this guy is sharp. I mean, this guy really knows his stuff. I mean, he's got more brain power in his pinky than you do on your best day. You know, you're so glad you got him. You're just grateful that you could get someone like this. And so he begins working the business. And sure enough, your calculations, they're right. This guy is incredible. He's gifted. He knows what he's doing. He understands the community. He jumps into the community. He knows the market. He knows how to see the market in that town. And he's really figuring things out. And within 6-7 months, he's really starting to see progress. He's really knocking it out. And you're really glad about this until you begin hearing that the people in his office, the people that you hired, the people that you technically still run and operate their business, they're talking about how strategic and how professional and how smart this guy is in comparison to you. And they're starting to evaluate. And they're actually starting to kind of wonder, like, well, why are you even around? I mean, look at this guy. He's incredible. And it's almost like they want you out. They don't want you visiting anymore. They don't want you. Well, you're shocked. You just kind of move on, but you're shocked. You know, you figure people talk, and besides, he's doing such a great job, and the business is thriving, and he doesn't seem to be a part of this chatter. He's a pretty humble guy. And things are moving forward. You just keep going and keep going. But again, until you hear that the things have really gone from bad to worse. And now people are taking sides, and they're arguing over who should run the company, and it's even got so bad that sales are being affected. These employees in this other business have stopped sending potential sales to you, to your office. And they're beginning to wonder, why should you even be around? And you're beginning to wonder, well, how did this happen? What should I do? So just go ahead, just for a minute. Put yourself in that guy's shoes. Put yourself right there. What would you do? How would you feel? You think you'd wrestle with some anger? Maybe a little sad? Think you'd have maybe some bitterness? You know, if you can put yourself in those shoes, you can begin to feel what it seems that the Apostle Paul must have felt when he heard that the church in Corinth was beginning to argue over his gifts versus other guys' gifts, other teachers' capacity. And as we've been making our way through 1 Corinthians, we have noticed the language is very clear. In Corinth, they had a great affection for human reasoning and human wisdom. And this affection was seen in Corinth overall in the entire culture because it was a thriving seaport community and they had a major Mediterranean trade route. And there was this wide influx of thinkers and philosophers who had come through. And some of these philosophers actually traveled from city to city as a way to make an income. And they would teach, and they would be very charismatic, and they would have well-thought-out arguments, and they'd be very articulate. And they'd draw a crowd, and people would listen to them, and they'd pay to listen to them. They were much like what you might think of with an entertainer today, a celebrity. And people were just drawn to them. And people would begin picking their favorite teachers who had come through, and they'd argue it over. Hey, I like this guy. No, this guy. Hey, way better argument than that one. No. This one, let me tell you, he was far superior. And there was this kind of banter that was going on. And the Corinthians loved this. They loved this kind of traveling teacher that would come through. And what was going on in the church in Corinth was a very real danger that they could start pulling that sense of identification with a particular teacher into their church community. That cultural affection for a certain kind of teacher would become the church affection. And they would pull that into the church. And in reality, that's exactly what happened. We see this going on with Paul and Apollos and Cephas and other teachers, that they were weighing the words of the teachers against one another, and they were weighing them based on style rather than substance. Last week, Charlie talked about Paul's warning to the Corinthians that it was possible to waste your life in the pursuit of worthless things by giving yourself over to human wisdom, to giving yourself over to living natural. Today, Paul warns the Corinthians about their wrong view of spiritual leadership, about how they could view their teachers. And he tells them how to get off this merry-go-round of comparison and criticism with their teachers. And he tells them how to do it by the way he dealt with their criticism. Take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1 and 2. And here's the question. Think about this question. You might jot it down. How do we learn to face criticism without being crushed by it? How do we do that? Paul has something really interesting to say in this passage for us. Verse 1. This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found trustworthy. Trustworthy. So right off the bat, Paul knows his identity. And he also knows the identity of all the teachers there in Corinth who they're taking sides over. Notice what he says. He says, this is how you should regard us. So for Paul, a spiritual leader was first a servant of Christ. That's the first thing we see. He was a servant of Christ. This isn't a new idea. We've seen it in the book. In fact, if you flip over to chapter 3, verse 8, this is what it says. What then is Apollos? What then is Paul? We're just servants through whom you believed, as the Lord assigned to each of us. So they understood who they really, really were. And here's what he's saying. The teacher's not the focus. Corinthians, the teacher is not the focus. We're just a couple of servants that God has used to bring you the gospel. That's all we are. He assigned each of us certain ones of you to give the gospel to. And that agrees with what he says next. Notice what he says in verse 1. He says they were servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God, which is a reference that he said earlier in chapter 2. Take a look at verse 7. Just flip back to chapter 2, verse 7. And here's what he's talking about. He's saying in verse 7, there's a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages. So here's what he's talking about. What had God decreed before the ages that he just now revealed that had been a mystery? It's the gospel. It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. And what he says, verse 2, what he says, it's required of stewards that they be found trustworthy or faithful to that gospel. So here's the deal. For Paul, a teacher's job was to be faithful to his responsibility. That's what a teacher's job is. A teacher's responsibility was to bring people to see and savor the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the reason his job was not just simply to help them see the gospel and pray a prayer and see the gospel just one time and just pray a prayer, but to actually savor the gospel many times over, again and again, is because he's got the gospel all over the letter. Take a look at chapter 1. We're not going to go through all these, but if you look at verse 17, you see the gospel. If you look at verse 18, you see the gospel. If you look at verse 23, gospel. 30, gospel. Go to chapter 2, verse 2, gospel. The letter is quite literally chocked full with the gospel. It's all over the place. And this is really, really, really helpful because they didn't know how God was going to solve this mystery of bringing people to him. And now, through Christ, it's been solved. And Paul was just telling them that. He's a broken record about this good news, that people can come to God through Christ. And the reason is he wants them to personalize that message. He wants them to personalize the gospel. Take a look at chapter 1, verse 23. Notice what he says about the gospel. It's the power of God for those being saved. The gospel is power. And as you look at these verses and you think about what Paul is saying, I think it has a lot to help us with in terms of how he saw himself as a spiritual leader when he faced criticism. And it's really pretty simple, but here it is. Paul knew his identity. He just knew his identity. Paul was comfortable in his own skin. He's just comfortable with himself. Without sounding really strange, Paul was good with Paul. Because he knew that God had called him. It was his deal. God had called him to be a certain kind of person, to serve the Corinthians by helping them to see and savor the gospel of Jesus Christ. And because that was his identity, here's the deal. He lived with freedom. He lived with freedom. He had great freedom. He wasn't waiting for the Corinthians to call him to a different message or a different way of life. He had the call. He had it already. You know, for you and I, you can live confident before God because you are confident of the call from God. You can live confident before God because you're confident of the call that comes from God. You know, when you and I are just living in the reality, just think about this. When you're living in the reality that God is at work and he's working through your life and you're trusting in him to do whatever he wants to do, there is tremendous freedom. And the reason is because your eyes are off yourself. Their eyes are on him. We just sang about it, the greatness of our God. We are seeing him for who he really is. The pressure is completely off. You're just looking to God and saying, do whatever's best. Do what you want. Hey, guess what? I am in your story. I haven't invited you into my life to make my story better. I am in your story. And you are doing whatever you want to do, whatever that might be. So listen, Paul lived free of criticism because he knew who he was. He knew his identity. And, you know, just real simple, just think about this. You know, if you're a parent, you've got kids that God gave you. God gave you to parent those kids. Enjoy those kids. Rest in the beauty and the reality that God gave you on purpose, the clan you have. Or you're married, or you're single. Guess what? God gave you your spouse. God gave you your station. This is where you're at. This is a good thing. And God is working because that's the call he has on you. Guess what? He will give you all that is required in the middle of that to enjoy him, to live in the flow of that, and to rest in him. You don't have to make anything happen. He's leading in. You know your call. You know who you are and your job. I know everybody says it's a tough economy. Guys are looking for different jobs. Gals are all, you know, looking for different jobs. How can I get a better job? This isn't working out for me. Even in the midst of trying to find a way to take care of yourself and your family, here's the good news. God isn't surprised. He's just not surprised. In fact, God is in some way right now orchestrating things to where you rest in him in the midst of what you're facing. He's orchestrating things in such a way where you learn more about him by what you're in the middle of. And so even if you're in a job where you feel you're underappreciated or undervalued, relax. God sees you. He's got your back. He's watching. He's got a call on you right now. God's working. And see, this is functionally where we miss it, isn't it? Because we want God to create a life for us around the idea of what we want rather than resting in the reality that His vision and His idea really is better. That we really are going to trust, really trust, that's the idea of believing, really rest in the God who is real and the God who is doing things versus resting in my opinion of what I think I should be doing. And you just lean in there. And see, that's why Paul could face conflict, he can face criticism, he can face comparison, and it doesn't seem like he's just going, man, I'm just beat up all the time. I'm sure it was affecting him, as we're going to see that, but he can lean into that. Verse 3, but with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. Interesting. In fact, I do not even judge myself. God. For I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. So he says, you know, I really don't care about what you think about me, which, let's just all be honest, doesn't that just kind of strike you a little arrogant? Really? I mean, you know, if I go to my wife and I say, what do you think about this, honey? And she says, you know, I don't know about that. You might want to reconsider how you're going to say that or what you think about that or, you know, this whole situation. You need to kind of, you know, walk a little more gently or do this differently. And then I turn to her and say, oh, that's great. I really don't care what you think. How's that going to work out for me? Let's just be honest about it. Is that a good moment? Hey, guys, is that a good moment? No, that's not a good moment. Application number one, don't do that, guys. So, guys, just make it simple this morning. Don't. That's dumb. That would be arrogant. But again, that's not what he's doing here. Okay, that's not what he's saying. And as I've been thinking about this, Tim Keller has really kind of helped me. He's a guy I really, really like in terms of his writing and teaching. But he helps me understand this, particularly in noticing that Paul uses the word judge several times here, if you notice that. And judge means to examine, to compare, or to give a verdict. And so Paul is saying, this is what's going on. I love you guys, but really, it's a small thing to me that your verdict about me as a teacher is that I'm inferior to Apollos, to Peter, or to any other teacher. It's a small thing to me. Because again, remember, he's being attacked. He's being referenced against other teachers. He's being sized up. Notice what he says next. He doesn't care if he's judged, not just by them, but by, what's he say? Any human court. By any human court. So Paul isn't before a court, right? So what's he talking about there? He's not before some Roman tribunal. There's no judicial body that he's in front of in this moment. But here's what's going on. The Corinthians are acting like a court. And they're giving him a verdict based on his performance as a teacher. And they're sizing him up and they're prosecuting him. And some are saying he's inferior and others are defending him. And Paul's saying, listen, my opinion of myself as a teacher and a spiritual leader is not based upon your opinion of me. It's just not. In fact, it's not based on anyone's opinion of me. At the end of the day, I'm not going to let your criticism sink so deep into me that it cuts me, that I can't sleep at night, because what people think of me is not the basis of how I live my life. Look at what he says next. Look how he closes out verse 3. It's interesting. I don't even judge myself. I don't even judge myself. What's that all about? What's going on with that? Look, he expands his range. I don't care about what you think. I don't care what they think. And I don't care what I think. I mean, is he laissez-faire? Is he kind of sitting on the beach, just kind of hanging out? Hey, man, everybody's for himself here. Everybody makes their own call. Everybody makes their own life. Don't judge me. I won't judge you. You know, is that what is the reality of what he's saying? Is he kind of, you know, the creator of Hang Loose? You know, he's really not. That's not the intent. In fact, I've heard this, and maybe you have as well, I've heard this verse referenced in terms of how we deal with sin, particular, you know, issues, personal sin and whatnot. People kind of saying, don't judge me, there's things going on in their life. He's not talking talking about that. He's talking about people assessing him as a spiritual leader. That's what's going on here. Paul's not saying that he doesn't watch his life, that he doesn't pay attention to his ministry, so that particular sin, pet sins, whatever they might be, are going to knock him out. That's not what he's saying. In fact, we're going to see in a couple chapters, he's real clear on that, that you do look at sin, you do judge sin. So he has something to say about that. That's not what he's saying. You know, another way I think sometimes we think about this is, you know, Paul was just disattached. He was Vulcan. He was just not emotionally connected to these people. He didn't care. You know, he was kind of like the robot on the screen. I get the gospel. You know, I mean, that's not Paul. He's not doing that. Not at all. But here's what I think is really interesting about this. Paul writes about this because in some way it did bother him. But not the way it typically bothers us. Because Paul, sometimes unlike us, he doesn't need their approval to prop up his sagging ego. He's not looking for them to give him something so that he feels better about himself. I think what Paul is driving at here is that he doesn't worry about having his identity questioned and criticized as a servant and a steward of the gospel because his identity has been secured in Christ. Paul sees himself, as something, as someone who God has given a call to. He's just following through on that. He's confident before God because he's confident of his call. So why should he worry about criticism? Why worry about the comparison that they're doing with him? And look how he continues in verse 4. For I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. So he says, I don't care what you think, I don't care what they think, I don't care what I think. But notice, he says, I don't even judge myself because of my conscience being clean. I mean, the reality is dictators can have clear consciences. It doesn't make them innocent. So what he's saying is my conscience isn't clear as far as I can tell, but even that doesn't make me, and here's the word, it doesn't make me justified. It doesn't make me acquitted or vindicated. It doesn't make me innocent. It's the same word that we see Paul using all over Galatians. We talked through this several years ago. This idea of being justified or acquitted with God. It's the same word he uses all over the book of Romans, if you've ever walked through the book of Romans. But here's what Paul is stating in reality. My thoughts about myself, for good or bad, do not have the power to give me a verdict about myself. Paul understands that the Corinthians are caught in a natural thinking trap. They're believers. They follow the Jesus of reality, the God who is real, but they're functionally living kind of natural. And here's the reality. That natural thinking trap is a performance trap. And that's what you're seeing here. They're comparing teachers to get some sense of identity, some sense of worth, some sense of personal goodness out of it associated with a particular spiritual leader. It's no different than if someone really is into music. Really, really, really is into music. And I'm kind of a casual observer of music, but they love to banter about their favorite band or their favorite guy, you know. They just, you know, Bryan Adams. Oh, Bryan Adams, he's like, man, he's the greatest rock star in the world, man. Back when I was in high school, Bryan Adams rocked. And, you know, it's just, you know, just identify so much with this guy. Or like, you too. Oh, man, Bono, he's just like changed the world. You know, and they're just like so into these different performers. Or their favorite author. Oh, you got to read Stephen King. Wow, Stephen King, the way he writes. Maybe let's think of another author. Okay, let's see. So they're into, but they're into their favorite author. You know, they're into, and they do this with teachers. We do this with teachers as well, don't we? We're no different. But notice, here's the deal. He doesn't get his identity out of how they have identity with him as a teacher. Here's what Paul is saying. He's saying your good or your bad opinion of me is not the verdict I'm looking for. In fact, my own good or bad opinion of myself isn't even the verdict that I'm looking for. And here's something to just think about. If you make your standards the standard, or other people's standards the standard for you, in order to feel good about yourself, if that's what you're doing, here's what you're going to battle. You're going to constantly waffle between pride when you succeed or depression when you fail.
constantly.
You're always high, you're always low. How did they think about me? What did they say? And you're always gauging, you're always evaluating based on what you receive and what you hear about how you think about yourself. You know, I am totally guilty of this. When I was thinking about this, it is not hard at all for me to live in the world of comparison. I mean, I love to hear people say, hey, that was good. Do you? You like to hear that? Your job, you love to have someone say, man, that was really, really well done. I think you're, you know, without you, where would we be? And what happens in that is there's nothing wrong with affirming or encouragement, but what happens is that is you begin translating your identity to what you're hearing about yourself. And before long, guess what? The verdict is in someone else's court about you. You're always looking for a verdict. It's kind of like, and this may be not the way you think about it, but it's like you're a vacuum cleaner with this hose connected to you. And everywhere you go, you're just looking to hook it in. Everywhere you go, somebody make me feel good about me. Somebody give me a verdict. Because you're living under this lack of verdict in your life. But here's what Paul tells us. I know, this is important. Paul says, I know both the good and I know the bad in me. I see my failures and I see my successes. And neither the good or the bad are my true identity. Paul doesn't see his sin and say, bad job, therefore I'm bad. He doesn't see his good and say, good job, therefore I'm good. He just will not be sucked into this vortex of being judged by others' opinions of him or his opinion of himself. He will not flip-flop back and forth between feeling good about himself and bad. Look what he says at the end of verse 4. It is the Lord. It is the Lord who judges me. Paul says, I'm resting in God's opinion of me rather than the fickle, ever-changing opinion of others or even my own opinion of me. I'm taking my chances on God's opinion of me rather than yours or even mine. I've left the estimation of my calling as a teacher to God. He knows best how to judge me. The only opinion that matters most is God's opinion. See, this is how Paul faced criticism with power and freedom, because he had entrusted the verdict of his life to another, and he was out of the courtroom. He was just out of the courtroom. Remember back in verse 4, where it talks about his conscience being a verdict? He's not even looking for a verdict anymore. He was incapable of giving himself a trustworthy verdict in his life. And listen, when you live for others' verdict on you, here's what you're doing. Every day, you are back in the courtroom. Every day, you're back in the courtroom and you're looking for a verdict. And Paul says, I'm absolutely done. And this is a truth I think that's absolutely foreign to me and maybe to you. Because when you let criticism sting you so deeply that you have to be on this emotional treadmill, if you have to do that, basically what you're doing is you are flip-flopping between thinking you're successful when you're good and a failure when you don't live up to your own expectations. So here's some questions that I would like you to ask yourself. But before we do that, just jot this down. Just think about this. Think about this. Let this kind of rest in your mind as you think about Paul before we move on. Here's what we see in Paul. He had entrusted himself and his judgments about himself to God. That's what he is doing. I'm not giving the estimation of myself anymore. And just jot this down. Notice this. Paul's not thinking much of himself or less of himself. He's not thinking much of himself. He's not saying, man, when I do really good, I feel proud. I feel really good about myself. But he's not thinking less of himself. Boy, when I blow it, I just can't make it through the day. I got to find something to make me feel good about myself. I mean, I shouldn't have done that. I'm a failure. He's not doing that. He's not thinking less of himself. Here's what you're seeing. Paul's just not thinking of himself. Paul's just thinking of himself less. He's just thinking of himself less. You could say Paul is not on Paul's mind all the time. He's just not thinking about himself. So ask yourself this. What would it be like to hear criticism, even from someone you may not even like, and say, hey, you know, this is just an opportunity for me to learn? Or maybe even an opportunity to change. Or ask yourself as it relates to your reputation, what would it be like if I didn't need honor but weren't afraid of it? If you didn't long for recognition but you weren't frightened by it? Or in terms of your appearance, think about this. What would it be like to look in a mirror and not admire what you see, but equally not cringe from what you see? Tim Keller says it this way. What would it be like if you didn't sit around dreaming about hitting self-esteem or self-promotion home runs? Where you were kind of like, oh, I got to have this, or oh, I got to be accepted by this crowd, or oh, I got to get this kind of job, or I've got to have these kinds of connections like this guy has, right? I really need this kind of physical attractiveness or beauty, so I beat myself up at the gym constantly because I just don't feel good about myself because I compare myself to everybody, and my body image is just out of whack. Just totally living for the verdict of everybody else. What would that be like? But at the same time, when you failed, at the same time, you didn't say to yourself, I am a loser. I am a horrible person. I never should have done that. What was I thinking? See, you didn't live in that waffling back and forth. What would that be like? Look at verse 5. How does he do it? Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. So Paul knows that Jesus is going to be a judge, and he will come back, and he will judge us by our faithfulness to the call to the life he has given us. And he'll judge our motives, and he'll judge our hearts, and he'll judge the reason we did what we did, and the reason we don't even know all of our motives. And we don't always know the things that we do and why we do what we do. And at times there's that excessive self-reflection as a way of saying, God, I still want to keep on the throne of my life. I still want to judge me. And Paul knows God will be the best one to judge him. The best one to judge him. Paul has given the judging role up to God. Totally given it up. He's completely free. Notice what he says next. He says that each will receive their commendation. Their commendation. That's kind of positive reward of some kind. But notice, he says commendation, not condemnation. So let's just think about this. So far, Paul lives free when he's faced with criticism because he knows his identity. He knows his calling. And when we live free, when we know what our calling is, we're called to the life that we have, and we rest there, we can live with that kind of freedom. God gave us our life, we rest with him. Here's what we see now. Paul lives free because he knew there would be a favorable verdict in the final day. Paul knew there would be a favorable verdict in the final day. In a sense, Paul already knew God's opinion of him. It will be commendation from God, not condemnation from God. For Paul, others' judgments of him do not carry the weight because they were not informed by God's judgment. Paul lived under the gavel sound of no condemnation, awaiting commendation for the task that God had given him. Because here's the deal. God determines the task. God assures that what we will do will have lasting importance. And God is the one who rewards the servant, wherever that is, for their faithfulness. God's the one. So listen, when you rest in God's opinion of you, you are not bothered by the ever-changing opinion of others. You can know God will call you guiltless at the end. Look at how he closes this section out, verse 6. I have applied all these things I'm teaching you. That's what he's saying. He's teaching the Corinthians this in the letter. And all the things I'm telling you about who I am and my calling, I've applied these to my life. I'm not talking about something that I don't understand. This is the reality of how I live my life. That's what he's saying, okay? So I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one another. So he knows that people have the propensity and the possibility to try to live in a comparison game, and they are doing that with him, and he's telling them, I don't do that. I don't want to live puffed up. I don't want to live superior. I don't want to have to look for a way to vindicate myself today. I'm off that treadmill. I don't want to do that anymore. And he's free because he knows who he is. And he knows what God has called him to do. And he knows he's going to have this verdict at the end that's going to be really sweet and good, whatever it's going to be from God. And so Paul is living for the benefit of others. He's showing them how to live this way because he knows, listen, trying to be superior to everybody is a tremendous weight. It's a tremendous, tremendous burden. Get off the burden, he's saying. He said, I don't want this for you, Corinthians. I don't want you to have this. And then notice what he says in verse 7. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you did not receive? What do you have that you don't receive? If then you received it, why do you boast? Why do you boast as if you did not receive it? He comes back to what he said at the end of chapter 3 in verse 22 where he says, all things are yours. He's saying, listen, God's given you everything for your good. God has done everything for you. You didn't work for it. You didn't deserve it. It wasn't your connections you got there that got you there. It's been received by God. It has not been achieved by you. So why are you boasting as if it is about your ability, as if it is about your effort, as if it is about your achievement? And right here, listen, we gotta sink our teeth into this, friends. Right here is where the gospel can help us. Because we talk about the gospel, but here's the deal. When you see that the gospel has been received by you, it humbles you. It totally humbles you. Just for a minute, we're just going to think gospel for a minute. Think about what he's saying here. Think about what's been received. Think about this. Ephesians 2 tells us that we were dead in our sins. Dead. That is not a little alive. That's not some idea that we can somehow get there. We were dead in our sins. Not fictionally, but in reality. We were dead. We were separated from God. And we were separated because our sin is what kept us separated. But God was rich in mercy. God was rich in mercy. He was rich in kindness. And he placed upon his own son all of that alienation, all of that separation, and judged it all as if Jesus was dying for our sin in our place. And we receive a verdict. Here's the deal. We receive a verdict of accepted, of forgiven, and perfect, because Jesus was our perfect, sinless substitute. He did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And Paul is saying, I am free of the courtroom, folks. I'm out. I'm done. Public opinion, again, I'm not trying to say I don't value criticism in some sense of learning, but I am not going to dictate my life by it. God went to the trial for me. He went to the courtroom for me. And because of that, I'm out of the courtroom. Paul says this. He says, Jesus was a lamb that was sheared. And he was silent before his accusers. And he was innocent. And he was taken to an unfair trial. And he was convicted unjustly. And he was put on an altar. And he was put on a cross. And he was sacrificed. And he did it because he was our substitute. Took our trial that we deserved, but the trial we never could have won. But he could. He chose to. He took our condemnation willingly so that we don't have to have it anymore. So when you say, Lord God, accept me because of what Jesus has done, then the only one whose opinion counts, who is willing to trade his son so that you could become a son, looks at you and he looks at me and he thinks precious. He looks at you and he looks at me and says, loved. Doesn't that humble you? Doesn't that grace just stop you in your tracks and say, wow, look at what you've done. Look at what I've received. And when you realize that is the gospel you have received, don't you want to get your life out of the courtroom of looking for a verdict about your life from others' opinions? Don't you want to rest in God's favorable verdict of you in the final day and just say, I'm done. I'm out of the courtroom. I mean, how can you worry about being snubbed or ignored when you live like that? How can you worry about playing the comparison game when your life is bought and you're free? You're free. listen, when you see yourself getting sucked back into the courtroom, just like me, if you wrestle with this, if you're sucked back in, let me just encourage you to say a few things to yourself in the middle of that. Say something like, God, actually talk to God, but talk to yourself. Your Spirit of God's in you. You can talk to Him. You can really, really just talk, you know? God, listen, I can be confident before God, before you, because I am confident of your call for me. I'm confident of the life you've given me. I know my identity. I'm a servant. I just want to be what you want me to be. I'm not trying to get a verdict out of this. I know there's a favorable verdict coming. It's been received by me, not achieved by me. And so tell yourself this. Think about this. So why am I letting the judgments of others affect me as if they are the final word on me? Why am I still comparing myself to others when the King of the universe was compared to the righteous standard of God, and He was found perfect in my place on my behalf? So folks, here's the reality. When those moments hit you, when you're tempted to compare, here's what you need to do and here's what I need to do. You need to relive the gospel right then on the spot, in the moment. Right then. You need to relive it when you pray. You need to relive it when you're tempted to compare your kids with other kids. You need to relive it when you're tempted to compare your job. Relive it when you're tempted to compare your house. Relive it when you're tempted to compare and criticize and stack up and judge your life in comparison to somebody else's life. Right on the spot. We need to tell ourselves the God of the universe has thought of me. He accepts me because of His sacrifice. He's given me my identity. Why should I live under the weight of comparison? When you get sucked back in, just say the deal's off. I'm done. The verdict's in, and I'm good. It's all good. I don't live by that standard. I don't have to live that. I'm good. God gave me my life. God gave me my calling. And I'm going to rest in Him. I'm going to learn as I go, but I'm not going to compare myself to everybody else. I'm not even going to listen to my own voices. I'm going to go to the gospel. I'm going to run to the gospel that gives me my identity. And this is what makes the Christian message so beautiful. Hang your hat on this one. Think about this. In traditional religion, good human performance is what leads to a good verdict from God. And so in traditional religion, whatever it is, you are on a treadmill, and you're constantly doing this. Sometimes it's fast, and you're going 6 miles an hour. Sometimes it's slow, and you're barely walking, but you're on a treadmill. Because your good performance matters in order to get a verdict. You better be good. You better be really good, in fact. You better be perfect. And you know that because you live that way. And I live that way, right? When we live as a traditional religious person under that system, we're living for performance. But here's what Paul tells us about the gospel. And this is just beautiful. The reality is when we have been given the verdict by God, the only reason we perform at all is out of gratitude. You do not perform to get God to like you anymore. You do not perform in order that some way God might be favorable in His blessing upon you in some way because you earned or merited it. Because the verdict is already in. 1 Corinthians 1:30 says this, God is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and our sanctification and our redemption. And the moment we lean into that, there's a new power in that moment and the power for you to get off that comparison treadmill. Listen, as we close, just think about this. The gospel is the music you keep tuning your life to get out of comparison. The gospel is the music you keep tuning your life to. It's not the noise of others' opinions that you tune your life to. When we see that everything we have is a gift from God, it humbles us and it sends us back to the gospel with gratitude. Everything comes from Him. So rest in that. Enjoy the life He's given you rather than comparing it all the time. Live in freedom that you've been given an identity. It is for freedom that Christ has called you. It is for freedom that you will be able to know right now a favorable verdict later. It is freedom, your freedom. You know there's a favorable verdict later. There is commendation, not condemnation. It's for freedom. So live in the life. Live in the life you have received. Live in the life that you have been given. I want us to do some gospel thinking on the spot right now. I want us to think about our lives as we go into a time of communion and prayer. And I want you to just bow your head, or you can stare at the ceiling, or you do whatever you want, but I want you to just reflect on the gospel in this area of criticism in your life. Just think about this. Bow your head, do what you want in terms of that. But I want you to think about this. Just talk to God. Are you free with God? Are you free with man because you're free with God? Are you living free? Are you still striving to get your identity from others' opinions? Or because you know God has already given you an identity? He's already called you to certain things. Are you free to use your gifts without comparing them to everybody else and saying you got to be this kind of person and admiring certain people with certain kinds of gifts? Are you free to use the gifts and rest in the reality that God gave those to you? Or, be honest, are you criticizing? Are you comparing others? Do you realize that when you do that, whether you think about it or not, you're basically saying, God, I know you're the judge, but I think I got a better handle on being the judge. Do you realize that when you're criticizing someone, you're basically saying, God, I know you'll give them a judgment, but I think I've got that one handled. I think I do that better than you. Is there someone that you constantly have to assess your life up against in order to feel good about yourself? And depending on how you're assessing, you're feeling really high or you're feeling really low. Folks, this is all God.